Last week, we entered into a whole new passage of Scripture, a whole new section of the book of Ecclesiastes. We had heard Solomon screaming out his lungs about doubts and problems and struggles he had. We heard his frustration, and we heard about his parties, and we heard about his exploits, right? He built these great works of art, and he had musicians, and he had women. This man has done it all. And for six chapters, we heard over and over again about all these great things that he'd been part of and searching for meaning in, all these great things that he had done. And yet, in this chapter, we come to chapter 7, something totally different. In my Bible, it's just labeled wisdom. And the theme that drives through this chapter is this man who's had everything. He says the times that he's learned the most in life are not the parties and not all the good days, but it's being in the house of mourning. The times that he's learned the most are not the new relationships he's found, but the old relationships that have broken apart. The times that he's grown the most and loved God the most have been some of the worst times. And last week I said it, just this text feels unlike any text we've seen. This feels like he's actually invited us in. It's so much more intimate. It's like you come to the door and the servant says he wants to see you. And he leads you back down this, through these giant doors, down this ornamented hallway that seems to go on forever. And you enter into this great hall. It was called the Forest of Lebanon, because all the cedars of Lebanon, it took over 100 of them just to hold up this giant roof. And you wander through this hall that held at one time the greatest parties this earth has ever seen. And then you turn around the corner and you enter into his throne room. And there is this giant golden throne. And there is the best dressed man you've ever seen. And yet he is aged. And he just wants to sit and chat. He says there are some things in life that you can only learn from experience. And he wants to share a bit of that with us. Today we continue in Ecclesiastes chapter 7, starting in verse 7. He leans over and says, extortion. Literally the word is oppression. Turns a wise person into a fool, and a bribe corrupts the heart. He says, after all of his years of experience, one of the things that he wants you to know is that extortion, the word here is the same word that's translated oppression and brutality in the rest of the book, that when someone resorts to using their power to hurt people, turns them into a fool. Extortion and bribe are good translations here, but the word for bribe just literally means a gift, and it's a bit narrow. Solomon here, when he leans in, he's not just talking about money here. He's talking about the temptation to not properly value people. So people, all of us, he says, have something wrong with us. If you've gotten anything out of the book of Ecclesiastes, you know that he thinks all of us are sinful. All of us are messed up. He's going to use the word twisted, corrupted. And he's going to say that all of us have something wrong with us. All of us have this selfishness that pulls against our desires and our emotions and our thoughts. All of us have this twisted in us so that we naturally love the wrong things, that we can naturally value a job more than we can value another person. We can naturally value a big house over another person. We can naturally value, you name it, your gifts, your success over other people. In fact, you can also value things over yourself, he says. Here's the thing, that when life gets tough, which for Solomon, that's the theme. Life is tough. When life gets tough, when you get out there and there are people fighting for jobs, fighting for resources, fighting for spouses, some of you single people, fighting for money, that we're all going to be tempted to run over and manipulate other people, to use other people for our own purposes. That at some point, some of you really smart guys are going to realize, you know what? I can use my intelligence to make other people look stupid and run over them. Some of you young ladies are going to realize, I can dress a certain way, or if I start to lose an argument, I can just start crying. And I can manipulate other people and get my way every time. That some of you who are put in leadership over others are going to realize, you know what, I can pay people less so that I can make myself more successful. It says that all the time we can oppress other people and suppress them to raise up ourselves. And so, notice Solomon here, he doesn't even mention the fact that this is a moral evil or that this breaks the heart of God. He doesn't even call it a sin, but it is. What's he say? He says, when you do that, when you put down someone else to elevate yourself, you become a fool. That everyone's going to hate you. No one's going to respect you. That you're going to be an idiot. Is that what you want? He says, now some of you don't even respect yourselves enough. That you actually value stuff over yourself. That some of you are willing to sell your life. Your life with your family, your God-given life, your God-given abilities, you're willing to sell it to someone for a title or a position or a job. And some of you are willing to sell it for much, much less. Here's the thing. If you're willing to sell out, if you're willing to accept even one bribe, or the word here is gift, at the cost of your dignity or your honor, the result is that you're going to destroy yourself from the inside out. It'll corrupt your heart. There's kind of a cheesy joke where a man walks into a bar and meets a woman. I know you're all waiting for one of those jokes on Father's Day. So there you go. A man walks into a bar, meets a woman, and they're leaning in. They're, you know, flirting playfully. It's great. And he leans in and, you know, just playfully says, hey, you know what? Would you sleep with me for $20 million? And the woman's like, what? She's actually flattered, like $20 million. And she starts laughing. She's like, oh, that's ridiculous. You know, I would have to think about, you know, in that hypothetical situation, I would have to think about that. That's just silly. And then he leans in and says, well, would you sleep with me for $20? And she's insulted, says, what kind of woman do you think that I am? Says, well, we've already established that. Now we're just negotiating a price. Solomon says that there are certain lines that you don't want to cross. That once you cross that threshold, once you're willing to sell your dignity, your honor, your very self, things are going to happen inside of you. The way not only other people view you, but the way you view yourself, it's going to destroy you from the inside, and it's not worth it. That we need to actually value people as an end and not as a means. We don't use people and we don't even use ourselves like that. We're made in the image of God. Verse 8. The end of the matter is better than its beginning, and patience is better than pride. Now, I love this. I wish all of us, we should get this. Like, if you want something tattooed on your arm right here, the end is better than the beginning. All right, what he's saying here is anyone can look like a champion when they start out. At the running line, you can get, you know, the special Nike shorts and the special shoes and the sweatband, and you can look like a champion at the starting line, but that doesn't matter. Like, okay, first trimester, every woman looks like the best mother ever. First date, every guy looks like the best husband ever. You just go through it. On the first day, when a person walks up front and says, I want to accept Jesus into my heart, they can look like the most spirit-filled, devotional person ever. They're going to be the perfect person. But here's the deal. It's really, really easy to start something. And it's really, really hard to finish. In premarital counseling, some of you can ask Brian and Ashley or John and Kendra or Scott and Monica. One of the first things I say is, if you want to meet with me, my goal, one of my stated goals, is to try and break you up. My philosophy is that 50% of all marriages end in divorce. Therefore, 50% of the people that I do premarital counseling with, I should try and break them up. They should never have gotten married. If I can break you up, then you shouldn't be together. Here's the deal, because it's very, very easy. It's so easy to love that person and adore that person and honor that person when they're young and attractive and you have no hardships and it's all about you. But it's very, very hard to go through the struggles of life together. Patience is better than pride, he says. Why don't we actually wait and see how things turn out before we start bragging? So you, like, I know you've been in a relationship for 2 weeks and it's magical, but why don't you just hold off before you write that marriage book? And you parents who just think you have everything figured out, why don't you wait till your kids learn the word no before you start handing out advice? He says, it's very, very easy to hand out advice and be prideful, to think you've got it all down. But let's just wait and see. Let's just see how this rolls out. You know, it's very easy. Christians come in. These young Christians get so excited and they're like, they read their Bible and they're all sold out, all fired up. And they come to me, some of them have, both in Dallas and here, and say, you know, I just can't stand this church. It's just full of like these lukewarm, suburban Christians who are so comfortable. And I'm like, I love your passion, but why don't we just wait and see how you look in 10, 15 years? What does it look like to live out the Christian life in our world right now? Why don't we just hang on? One of the great trash talk moments of world history is 1 Kings chapter 20. Ben-Hadad, this evil king from Aram, he gathers this coalition of armies. They come down to Israel and they're ready to decimate Israel. And when Israel gives them all kinds of gold and silver and says, please don't hurt us. And yet they keep asking for more. And so eventually the king of Israel says, daggone it, enough's enough. We're not going to give you any more. And the king comes down, and this is ancient Near Eastern cursing here. He says, may the gods deal with me, be it ever so severely, if enough dust remains in Samaria to give each of my men a handful. So Ben-Hadad comes in. He is cussing mad. He's yelling at the king of Israel, says, may the gods damn me if I don't wipe you off the face of this planet. And here's the line. The king of Israel answered him, 1 Kings chapter 20, verse 11. Tell him, one who puts on his armor should not speak as one who takes it off. Why don't you just wait and see how this goes down, friend? Maybe you shouldn't brag until it's over. And so the king of Aram goes back to his camp, and they don't take this threat of Israel seriously at all. And in fact, it says they all go back to the camp and get drunk. And in the middle of their drunken camp experience, the Israelites come in and wipe them out. And this is what Solomon's saying. His wisdom says, be patient, not prideful. Let's wait and see how things finish, because it's very easy to start well and very hard to finish well. Patience is better than pride. Better than a sexy honeymoon is that day when you're holding your spouse's hand in the hospice unit. Better than that first kiss is the last kiss, a kiss that has 50 years behind it, a kiss that says, I have been through everything with you and I still love you. That's better. Better than committing your life to Christ is walking with him for 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 years. Better is the end than the beginning. If you spend any time with Solomon, you realize that he is not a real chipper guy. He's very, very honest about how hard life is and how messed up people are and how messed up he is. He's just right out there with all of these things. And in it, he says, when you start recognizing that, when you start seeing how hard life is, some of you are going to snap. Some of you are going to snap in craziness, and some of you are going to snap in anger. And he addresses that. Verse 9, watch this. Do not be quickly provoked in your spirit, for anger resides in the lap of fools. Do not be explosive in your anger, for anger, that type of explosive anger, sits in the lap of a fool. Let's talk anger for a minute. Some of us have an unhealthy view of anger, or at least an unbiblical view of anger. Let's start out. If we were just to blank the slate of everything you've experienced and everything you think about anger and all those pictures of Jesus, like holding kids' hands and walking with the flowing hair in the valley, just throw that out of your mind for a minute. And let's just look at the Bible, what it actually says about anger. You're going to find that the scriptures have some solid examples of what they consider righteous anger. Just this last week, and I'm not going to tell you why, but just this last week, I was meditating in my soul on Nehemiah chapter 13. Can I tell you what happened? Nehemiah finds a bunch of people living in open sin, endangering the entire community in Israel. And so this is how he details his response. This is how he responded to those people. He says, "I rebuked them and called curses down on them. I beat some of the men, pulled out their hair, and made them take an oath in God's name." Okay, I want you to picture this. This is righteous Nehemiah, one of the godliest men throughout history. He has a book of the Bible named after him. Here he is with two men in a headlock, clumps of hair on the ground, bloody noses, saying, "You better swear by God that you'll never do it again." Some people need a righteous beating. It's in there. John chapter 2. I don't know if you remember Solomon's great struggle. His great struggle in faith was the fact that the poor are oppressed and nobody seems to care. Well, that's because Solomon had not yet seen Jesus. Jesus, in John chapter 2, he comes into the temple and sees the poor oppressed. And unlike all the other religious leaders, unlike all the other worshipers who go in there and don't care, don't do anything about it, what does Jesus do in John chapter 2? He starts yelling, he starts flipping over tables, and it says he takes a cord, a rope, and he starts whipping people and animals. Some people need a righteous whipping. Now, especially to you fathers today, but all of us who struggle with anger, aren't you glad? Aren't you glad that the scriptures actually have these examples? Aren't you glad that God gives us examples that sometimes godliness looks like putting someone in a headlock? That sometimes godliness looks like whipping people? That sometimes becoming like Christ means becoming angry? That God gives us permission. You can be angry. That anger is this powerful force. It's a powerful force that can be unleashed for good. It's a powerful motivator that can drive you to battle injustice, battle what is wrong, what is evil in our world. And you should. You can be angry. And in fact, at times, to be like Christ, you should be angry. But there's one big qualifier here. Ephesians chapter 4, the Apostle Paul says it this way: "In your anger, do not sin." If you want a better picture of what that looks like, he's quoting Psalm chapter 4, verse 4. This is King David, Solomon's daddy. King David, who is known for some of his anger, it says literally in the Hebrew, "Tremble," like you can be shaking mad. "And do not sin. When you're on your beds, search your hearts and be silent." That at times you're going to be so angry. But that anger, if you're not careful, can turn into vengeance, can turn into hatred, can turn into destruction. That you can do things that you can't undo. That you need to pray out your anger. You need to make sure your anger is righteous. Make sure you're defending God's cause and not your pride. That we need to make sure that we're mad about the right things and the right way. That we need to make sure we don't lose control. So what does David say? He says, "Tremble. Be shaking mad and do not sin." You need to take a time out. When you're on your beds, you need to search your heart first. You need to be silent before God. You need to pray to God. "God, I'm really, really angry about this and I want to put someone in a headlock. Would you have me do that?" "Do not be quickly provoked," Solomon says. Having seen his dad, having seen the way anger can destroy people, it says, "Do not be quickly provoked, because of explosive anger can lead you to do and say things that could destroy you, that could turn you into a fool." Verse 10. Do not say, do not say, stop saying this. Why were the old days better than these? For it is not wise to ask such questions. Like, that is not a helpful question. Or another translator puts it this way. That's a dumb question. Don't say this. It's not helpful. Here's the thing. Solomon is really going to push us. I don't know if you remember early on, chapter 2, he talked about the myth of progress, chapter 1 and 2. This idea that life is getting better, that's a myth. But he's also going to say the idea that life was much better back then is also a myth. We have these myths, right? When were those good old days, is Solomon's question. When were those? Well, in church, you'll hear things like, well, you know what we need to do? We need to get back to the early church. We need to go back to Acts chapter 2. Do you remember? Acts chapter 2, they're all sharing everything in common. They're meeting together. They're breaking bread. They're devoting themselves to the apostles' teaching. If we just got back to that, then life would be good. Those were the good old days. But Solomon wants to ask us a few questions here. Like, okay, so why? Do you know why they were sharing all their possessions in common? Because when a Jew converted to Christianity, started following Christ, they lost their house, their family, their synagogue, and their job, the marketplace. They were kicked out of all of that. So I want you to imagine this. Huge, huge sections of the church. Half the church is now homeless and jobless, unemployed. Oh, that would be great, wouldn't it? Do you know why they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching? Because no one had a Bible. There were thousands of new converts and 11 trained men to teach them. Like, you had to hang out with the apostles because that was the only way you could possibly learn anything. And during that time, there's explosions of cults and false teachers, people getting drunk at communion. False teachers coming in and stealing all the money from churches. Oh, those were the good old days. If we could just get back to those days. The other thing that we hear all the time, especially in churches, is that we need to get back to the America of the forefathers. And I agree. Just like in the early church, there were some good things. In the early church, there were some good things. In the America of our forefathers, there were. But you have to ask, I mean, which part do you want to get back to specifically? Do you want to go back to the fact that only men can vote? Do you want to go back to slavery? Do you want to go back to the pillage and murder of Native Americans? Which part of that do you want to go back to? That the good old days are not so different than today. They just swap their sins. They choose different ones. Solomon says maybe the good old days weren't really as good as we think. Like, the reality is that each era has its own special variety of perversion. So think of it this way. The change across time is a change in style, but not content. So you can take a sinner and you can put bell bottoms on him, or 40 years later, you can put skinny jeans on them. But you still have a sinner. And the fact of the matter is, from the day people started putting on pants back in the Garden of Eden, like, you want to know the good day? It was before people put on pants. Adam and Eve naked in the garden. That was a good day. Those were the good old days. But ever since then, it's just a matter of style. There's only so many ways you can cover up a sinner. But the problems of sin and brokenness and a cursed life are problems that will only go away when Jesus Christ comes back. Even if the good old days were as good as you remembered, it's no way to live. One of the struggles that I see in a lot of Christians is that they're always trying to get back to that feeling they had the first day or month when they started walking with Jesus Christ. They think, oh, that's what it means to be a good Christian, to have this euphoric feeling, those first days when you place your faith in Christ. And those are good days. Don't get me wrong. But the fact of the matter is, all that seasoning, those dry times, those tough times, those questions you go through, they grow, your roots have to grow deep during those times. And it's from those times that you learn to bear good fruit, mature fruit, fruit the way it's supposed to look like. Couples think, oh, what was it? Remember what it was like before we had kids? Remember when we were first engaged? That's what the true romance is. Well, you know, it's different. It's true. But the fact of the matter is it's over time you change, and you will never find happiness in your marriage now by seeking a marriage that no longer exists. Or to put it in Solomon's words, stop it. That's dumb. This is an echo of chapter 3. The idea that old days are better than these. The idea that you're trying to escape what God is sending you. That Solomon says, if you remember chapter 3, there are seasons of life. Each season has its own peculiar hardships and its own special beauty. Like, you cannot change the season that you're in, and you can't even speed it up. You have to go through the season. But here's what you can do. You can make the most of every season. So when it's winter and it's cold, it's true. Everything looks dead and it's cold and it's hard. But you can also bundle up. You can spend more time inside. You can sleep longer. You can go make a snow angel. And when it's summer, you can go outside. You can work harder. You can work longer. You can go on vacation. You can go swimming. In the same way, there are seasons of life that you cannot change the season, but you can make the most of it. So stop fighting against the seasons. Are you self-aware? Is it a springtime for you? Should you be planting? Is there new growth and new life and new opportunities? Is it a summer for you? Should you be tanning and going on vacation? Is it a fall? Is it a harvest where you should be reaping? You should stop doing new things. You should be reaping and gathering in all the things that you've been planning in times past. Is a winter? If it's a winter and it's dark and it's hard and it's cold, well, then you need to bundle up. You need to pull your friends in. You need to make the most of the joys that God sends you. Last Monday, I sat down and it's my day off. We call it the daddy day off in my household. It's like a weekly holiday. And so I sit down, and I know this sounds, well, it is what it is. This is what I do in my free time. Like, the best way I could spend that morning, I sit down and I open up a medieval history book. And I'm sitting there, and I'm so excited to read my medieval history book. And I get like half a paragraph in, and Jillian interrupts me. And then I help her with something, and then I come back. And then I start to reread that and get about halfway through that. And then Caleb comes up. And the next thing you know, they're fighting. And the next thing you know, I'm wiping noses and I'm getting apple juice. And so after about 20 times of reading the same page over and over and over again, I closed the book and set it down and realized that this is not the season of life to read books. There was a season when I would sit down and spend all day reading medieval history books, and it was beautiful for me. But that is not the season I'm in. And I could be bitter about that. I could fight that, or I could do what I did. I set the book down, and we made a 7-foot-tall Lego tower, and my kids loved it. And believe it or not, I loved it. You know, the season of life I'm in is the season where there are toys everywhere, where there are kids and dirty diapers, and I never have any personal space. That's the season that God has led me into, and I can either fight it or I can enjoy it. What season are you in? Are you going to fight it? Are you going to look for another season? Are you going to wish for the next one? Are you going to enjoy the season that God has called you to? Do not say, why were the old days better than these, for that is a dumb question. Verse 11, wisdom is like an inheritance. It's a good thing and benefits those who see the sun. Wisdom is like a shelter, as money is a shelter. For the advantage of knowledge is this: wisdom preserves those who have it. One of the reasons why we love Solomon so much is because this guy does not over-spiritualize anything. You know what he just said? He just said, you would like a big pile of money right now, wouldn't you? You would. Wouldn't you like it?
I would.
A big pile of money. Wouldn't that be great? And he says, you know, if you would like that, why would you like a big pile of money? And he says, let me tell you why. Because money can protect you from hardships in life. It can comfort you. It can surround you. So if there's any type of attack you can imagine, money can almost protect you from that. So legal attacks, you can hire a lawyer. So the weather comes, you can buy yourself the biggest house ever. So your car, you can now buy a Volvo that has a million different safety features. You can protect yourself with money, and we like it. And Solomon says, so if you like money, you should like wisdom too. Wisdom can do a lot of those same things. It can protect you from a lot of hardships in life. It can save you a lot of unnecessary pain in this life. Being wise with your money can save you from economic ruin. Being wise with your employment can save your job. Being wise with your family can protect your relationships, can protect your kids. That wisdom can protect you. Now, we spend a lot of time pursuing money. Maybe we should spend a little bit more time pursuing wisdom. And then he closes, as he closes almost every section. Consider what God has done. Like, after you look over all this other stuff that we've just talked about, after you look at extortion, the way people use each other, after you look at all the ways that we long for the past or long for the future, after we look at all the hardship and all the ways that we're abused, he says, consider this. Consider what God has done. Who can straighten what he has made crooked? When times are good, be happy. When times are bad, consider this. God has made the one as well as the other. Therefore, no one can discover anything about their future. God is going to give you some good days. Days when you wake up and you just want to pinch yourself. You're like, is this a dream or is this really my life? I mean, days when you have new mountains to climb and great people to travel with. Days when the sun's shining and you can smell the flowers. Days when your kids are obedient. Days when your spouse just looks sexy. Days when food tastes good and when you're going to travel and there are new opportunities and new life and new growth and lots of laughter. There are going to be good days, but the same all good, all sovereign God is also the God who makes the sun rise on bad days. That there are going to be days when everything goes wrong, days when we lose, days when everything breaks, days when relationships tear apart, days when things come to an end, days that are filled with tears and hurt and loneliness. And Solomon wants to leave us with this one question. If you're going to take from God those good days, are you going to trust him with the bad days as well? Will you trust God when you don't know what tomorrow holds? You don't know if it's going to be good or bad. Are you going to try and do this on your own? There are preachers out there right now who are promising everyone who listens that if you trust in Jesus Christ, you'll enter a new season of life that will only be good days. That you will be prosperous in your money, in your finances, in your relationships. Everything will succeed. But that's a lie. God doesn't promise that if you follow Jesus Christ, everything will be good. Just look at Jesus' life. Jesus had some good days. Turning the water to wine. A giant Galilean wedding feast. And at the end, what does Jesus do? How does he finish out the wedding feast? He takes 150 gallons of water and turns it into the best wine you've ever tasted. That had to be a good day. Calling of Matthew. Matthew is sitting there. He's sitting at his tax collector's booth, and everyone hates him. Nobody likes him. He's a coward. He's betrayed the nation. Everyone hates this man. And Jesus comes up to him and says, I don't hate you. Like, I want you to come follow me. Come, I want you to leave that behind you. I want to show the world what my grace can do to anyone. And so Matthew drops his old way of life and immediately follows Jesus Christ. And what's the next scene? The next scene is Matthew invites all of his friends who are irreligious, all of them, all the prostitutes, all the riffraff of the world, invites him to the house and says, "You have to meet this guy." That was a good day. Feeding of the 5,000, walking on water, preaching of the Sermon on the Mount. Those were good days. But at the same time, you think of Jesus starts his ministry. He's in the middle of the desert, literally starving to death, 40 days of fasting, all alone, and Satan himself shows up to personally tempt him. That had to be a bad day. Shows up at his hometown. And his friends and family not only disagree with him, but they hate him so much that they want to throw him off a cliff. You got to think that's bad. He's deserted by the majority of those who are following him. The one who is closest to him took a bribe, sold him out, and betrayed him with a kiss. He was falsely accused, beaten, scourged, mocked, executed. If ever there was a bad day in the history of the universe, it was that day. Jesus, the very Son of God, if he, the one whom we're supposed to model our lives around, if God didn't save him from hardship and suffering and bad days and dry seasons, why do you think he would treat us differently? Notice this isn't the end of the story, though. Jesus went through all of those bad days, but he trusted his Father in that. What's Jesus' famous prayer? He says, "Not my will, but yours be done." That if you send me through nothing but bad days, if you kill me, if you take me to a cross and nail me there, I will still follow you. No matter what that road leads down, I will still trust you. And when he does that, 3 days later, God raises him from the dead and exalts him above every name and every power and every authority. That's a good day. That Jesus in his earthly life shows us that God's pleasure and acceptance does not mean you won't have bad days. That following God doesn't mean you will escape hardship and suffering and dry times and winter seasons. It does not mean that. But Jesus' resurrection life shows us that suffering and hardship and death and winter and all the things that we go through, the broken relationships and the loneliness, the evil of this world does not get the final say. The Father does. And all good, all sovereign God speaks above all that. And what he declares is good will ultimately be good. What he declares is life will ultimately live. Invitation of Christ is not come and have a great life. Experience the wonderful spirit-filled life with me. It is wonderful spirit-filled. But the road that he goes down is pick up your cross and follow me. That the road we're called to go on is full of bad days and hardship and suffering. But if we follow God, if we trust God through those hard times, there's resurrection and there's glory and there's hope. And that along the way we can learn to enjoy the season that God has put us in. Pray with me. Father, thank you for Solomon and for these heavy words that you've given to us. Father, I pray for those now who are here, Lord, who are in a season of life that they do not enjoy. People who have been used and misused, who have abused themselves, who have not valued themselves. They've sold themselves in some cheap way. They've sold their dignity. They've sold their honor. Lord, for those who've been hurt, those who've been abused, those who've been mistreated and used, Lord, thrown away. God, I pray for those who are in seasons where it is dry, those who are in winter right now, Lord. God, I pray that you would show each of us how to trust you with our bad days, trust you in those dry times, to recognize the season that we're in and make the most out of it and not fight it, not long for the past and not try and escape the present, Lord, but trust you with today because we know that you hold tomorrow. Pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.